The hate crimes debate begins anew at the State House. The government shutdown comes and goes. That, plus a gun bill gets holstered and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 26th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, debate on a hate crimes bill was emotional and at times heated as the Senate committee kicked off conversation on the issue.
The legislation would allow judges to impose harsher sentences if a crime was committed in part because of a victim's characteristics, such as race, religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity. More than a dozen people and organizations spoke in favor of the bill, including business groups, a Bloomington transgender woman, and prosecutors. Religious conservative groups opposed the measure. They argue it discriminates against anyone not included on the list of protected characteristics. Lakeisha Gardner, an African-American woman from Fort Wayne, also spoke against the bill, but because she says it doesn't go far enough. Gardner's 15-year-old son Jason was beaten by a white man last year. The attacker, who used racial slurs, was recently sentenced to 30 days behind bars.
Is the hate crimes bill headed for another defeat? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, are proponents of this bill going to be disappointed once more?
I hope not. I mean, 45 states have this. There's no excuse for Indiana not having a hate crimes bill, particularly when we had that unfortunate connection with the Charlottesville incidents. It seems to me we ought to stand up and say it's bad enough that you commit crimes, but if you commit crimes for racially or gender-motivated or religious-motivated reasons, it's more reprehensible, and the penalty needs to be increased. And I really think it's past time. We've been talking about this for almost 30 years. I can remember when Evan Bayh was governor, we tried to get something passed on hate crimes and couldn't get it done. Come on. The only excuse would be that you're in favor of that kind of action. That's the only excuse. And I don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. I understand that people want a separate crime. I'm not sure you can get a separate crime for it. But I do think that the penalties ought to be clearly available to be enhanced by the judges by a hate crimes bill.
The sides here haven't changed that much. You have particularly religious conservative groups who oppose this. They believe you're policing thought and things like that. Have things not changed enough that the result's going to be the same here?
Well, the wrong that we're that the attempt here is to police thought. The attempt here is to police very specific violent acts that are done for a that are acted or that are done to you for some reason. Those reasons have been laid out in the bill. Now, the far left thinks it doesn't go far enough. The far right either doesn't want it at all or wants things taken out of the bill, such as transgender protections. Whether or not you even believe in the transgender piece, or if you're, you know, a conservative who thinks that's just all nonsense, it doesn't really matter. I mean, that population, more than any population, needs some enhancement and some protection because they're the ones who are targeted the most. So I hope something does pass. It would be really unfortunate if there's a headline in the paper here in a week that either some of these protections were removed for people who are being targeted, or the bill fails altogether, particularly in the context of as many states as have passed this. And if you just put it in the context of the Amazon announcement,
yeah.
I mean, we're the only state that's not right on this list in that mix of states.
Thank you for my transition, which is that was brought up at Tuesday's hearing, which is, you know, and obviously because we made the Amazon shortlist, that's the name at the top of the list. But there's other things that Brian Bosma hinted at this week, big opportunities that Indiana might pursue. Is something like that going to be the thing that might push this finally to the finish line?
Well, it's I would not be the one who coined the phrase money talks. Economic pressures have been brought to bear on this issue or related issues. Let's talk about, you know, what gender can use what bathroom, for instance, in Texas and in North Carolina, where the suggestion that companies might not expand or relocate to your state if you don't have what is seen as a set of open statutes that ensure that everybody, every employee or prospective employee is treated fairly. That also could be professional sports groups or organizing bodies that have amateur athletic events in a given community.
We saw that with RFRA here, quite frankly.
With NCAA and some of the threats. So ultimately, I would not be surprised if that aspect of this, the economic pressure and the notion of the black eye that's associated with being one of five states or whatever it is now.
And that list may be getting shorter because Georgia is moving legislation.
And that would certainly
for that very
reason.
Can you
have it in Georgia and not in Indiana?
Well, there's a lot of things Georgia has that Indiana doesn't have. John, I want to ask this, though. If you take out gender identity, which seems to be the thing that folks who are opposed to this care most about being removed from that list, if you remove that and still pass it, is that still a black eye?
It's pointless. At that point, it's pointless. I think Mike makes a very good point about that. Transgender people are among those who are most targeted because of their situation. You take that out, and you might as well not even bother. Maybe that's what they want. And I think the other point that Mike makes is if you've got the people on the far left saying it's not enough and the people on the far right saying it's too much,
that
you're probably right on
right.
the mark. And so I think for all the other reasons that have been mentioned here, it's past time to get something.
I would just observe that taking it out, that provision out, and then passing it might be worse in terms of what I just described as out-of-state economic pressures than not passing it at all.
What does it say? It's okay to beat up transgender people? I mean, what is the message
that
we're sending?
That's essentially what it says, and that's why it's pointless. And
you'd never get it in. I worked on the effort to expand civil rights a couple of years ago. We knew through that process if we took transgender protections out of that part of the code, we would never get it back in as a standalone amendment. It's all got to move together. It can't move at all. Or they come up with this other lane, which is they create an enhancement and give judges enough flexibility to say, this person was attacked for a very specific reason that is
And technically, state law does that already. There is a catch-all in the aggravator sentence that says a judge can consider whatever he or she wants when they are sentencing someone. But one of the things that's changed this year is that Brian Bosma is now saying, yes, you can technically sentence people for this, but it doesn't explicitly say that, and clearly that's a PR problem or a perception problem that Indiana needs to solve.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, it is a perception problem,
it's
but it's also what's
question.
Morally right to
right.
do.
Right. And this is not a vacuum happening in a vacuum. Keep in mind that the RFRA debate, which you mentioned a moment ago, still in some the perception of some people around the country, they think, oh, Indiana, that's that state that doesn't treat transgender people
that's
or
true.
People with different, either homosexuals or lesbians, with the same courtesies and legal rights.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will hate crimes legislation pass in the 2018 session? A, yes, or B, no? Last week's question, I should note, we've had a bit of a spike the last couple of weeks with unusually high response rates, both questions having to do with Luke Messer. Last week's question, was Luke Messer's win in the GOP Senate straw poll, quote, important momentum, as he said, for his campaign? 81% say yes, it was. 19% say no, it wasn't.
We know what volunteers were doing.
If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. While the federal government shut down this week, only to reopen days later as lawmakers reached a temporary compromise.
The funding bill signed into law Monday to reestablish full government functions only lasts through February 8th. The measure also extended the Children's Health Insurance Program for 6 years after Congress let the program's funding lapse last year. Part of the agreement to end the shutdown relied on assurances from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that his chamber will take up action to deal with immigration reform and the DACA program, whose hundreds of thousands of enrollees are at risk of deportation. Indiana Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly voted each time through the standoff to keep the government open and was part of a bipartisan group of senators, some credit with ending the shutdown.
Mike O'Brien, if you're Joe Donnelly, did you manage this process the best way possible when it comes to re-election?
That question is phrased exactly right, because the answer is yes, and the only reason was for re-election. And day one of this shutdown, I think blame went to Republicans, because we control everything. As Anne has pointed out in the past, we control everything, and so intuitively you go, well, the Republicans are in charge of everything, so how could they possibly not be to blame for this? Well, of course, the answer is we need 60 senators to avert this. Minority Leader Schumer, Chuck Schumer, released enough Democrats, including Joe Donnelly and Manchin and the other guys who are at the top of the list of being vulnerable, and let them vote to keep it open. They manufacture this crisis, get nothing for it, and then they point at Donnelly and go, what a hero for saving us from this crisis we created. So, yes, it was perfectly played for only political reasons by Senate Democrats and Joe Donnelly.
Did Joe Donnelly manage this the best way possible for re-election?
Well, he did what he thought was right, which is what Joe Donnelly always does. He always does what he thinks is right. But what's interesting to me about this is, you know, when it's politically okay for the Republicans to shut it down, I still remember Mike Pence up in front of the audience saying, shut it down, shut it down. And your own president last week saying, what we need is a good shutdown. You know, the irony of this is not lost on anybody. We need to deal with the immigration issue, and particularly with the Dreamers issue. And I think what Schumer has done here is, assuming that McConnell can be trusted to keep his word, okay, assuming. And if not, I think you can forget anything happening after February the 8th. But if he can be trusted to keep his word, then he's done what he should do and force him to agree to a vote. And instead of saying good because the shutdown ends, the president and the vice president get up there and start attacking Schumer. You know, I look at this and say, when you're supposed to be negotiating with these people, which is, of course, the mistake McConnell made in the first place, is not, you want Democratic votes, but you don't want them at the table discussing what ought to be in the content of the bill you want them to vote for. So now, if they've reached across the aisle and they want to work with Democrats, I think the solution is there. But we have to have McConnell keep his word.
So you're headed for another showdown around early February. If there's another shutdown, how does Donnelly manage that one?
Well, I'm still reeling in the assertion that Mike made that this was all done for Joe Donnelly's benefit.
Really?
The whole shutdown was for Joe Donnelly's
pretty
benefit.
Pretty creative.
That's
you must
pretty,
have a lot more pull.
That's
I
pretty
thought.
Good.
A lot of credit. It was really smart.
You know, I think that he's done what you would expect him to do and then take it as it comes. I think he's been remarkably consistent in that way. And so you look at it, whatever happens between now and February 8th, and gosh, a lot can happen in that 2.5 week or 3 week period. It's amazing how fast events move these days.
The shutdown was this week. It seems like
it happened a year ago. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that the best advice anyone could give Senator Donnelly, and what I think will be the case with him, is that you wait and see what the conditions are and how they fit and how they square with what you've said in the past. Because the moment he deviates from that is the moment he enters peril.
Well, so I think seems, if McConnell doesn't keep his word, that's a different story.
It seems that Donnelly, as Mike may have pointed out, he had a pretty clear path on this one. Does the next one get a little tougher, especially if it's one that might last a little longer?
Sure. I think that we have seen time and time again that even if Americans collectively feel are passionate about an issue, as they overwhelmingly seem to be with DACA, for instance. They want to give Dreamers a path to be able to stay in this country legally and not separate families, et cetera, et cetera. And in the past, there have been other issues that people care about, whether it's controlling the federal budget. But when you juxtapose that with shutting down government, and all of a sudden it becomes very real. You know, I can't call about my question about Social Security or getting my passport. And then all of a sudden, all the high-mindedness that goes with passion for a given issue is like, just get this thing open. So that's a danger. The other thing is, when you tie it with DACA, I think the chessboard may change between now and then, because we're seeing, even today, the White House signaling that the framework, as it calls it, on the issue of immigration actually might stake out a position, the White House might stake out a position that's even more generous in terms of immediate amnesty, if they don't use that term, for DACA, which actually then changes the dynamic in that then you have the immigrants, then you have, right wing of the Republican Party.
Right, then you have problems with the Republicans.
And then you have almost a different coalition, and the battle line, instead of being here, is all of a sudden now over here.
So I suppose, as John Katzenberger said, you
wait and see.
That's for a few weeks ago.
A House committee dramatically scaled back a bill this week that would have eliminated Indiana's handgun license requirement.
The committee rewrote the measure entirely. It originally eliminated the need for any Hoosier to obtain a permit to carry a handgun in public. Instead, the bill now extends one type of handgun license from 4 years to five, which will allow permit holders to avoid background checks every time they buy a gun. The only background check would be every 5 years when they renew their permit. The legislation also eliminates the fee to obtain a lifetime handgun license. Those license holders would still be subject to background checks for each gun purchase.
John Schwanis, proponents of the original measure say they'll be back, but will their luck really change here?
The luck? I have no doubt that it will be back. Don't get me wrong. I think that's the case. But I think what we've seen throughout the session from leadership on this issue, because of just how touchy all sides are on this, is point to Washington and say, because of issues in terms of reciprocity that are being unfolding at the federal level about how one state regards another state's handgun permits and so forth, we need, it's prudent for us to wait and see what happens elsewhere. And that certainly is, A, valid, and, two, actually a good cover if, in fact, you're wanting to not address the issue in that comprehensive a fashion this year.
But you have law enforcement groups who are pretty steadfastly against removing the requirement no matter what. That doesn't seem likely to change, so is, again, proponents of the original measure, is their luck going to change on this issue?
I think they may have seen a bridge too far. And I think John's analysis is right. You have conflicting state laws and you have reciprocity and all those other practical issues, but you also have this notion that, you know, you ought to be able to show that you're responsible for these things. You ought to have to, the law is that you should register the firearm and that you should have a license to carry it. People change, circumstance change. If you give a lifetime permit, well, what happens if they do something? You have to go through extra to pull it away and make changes. I think the scheme that they've had now is well settled, and to make the change that they proposed was really just a move too far.
Was this the right move by the House committee?
Yes, it was. I mean, we have enough guns. We just have enough. We have more guns than we have people, for crying out loud. And it has gotten so crazy. It is the only constitutional right that isn't subject to almost any restrictions. And it's ridiculous. Okay? It's about time we had sensible gun control. Nobody's prying, certainly not Trump, prying the guns from their cold, dead fingers. But we need background checks. We need checks and balances on this. What have we had, 50 school shootings so far this academic year?
No, they've had 11 in 23 days.
Yeah. In 23 days, but I think
right.
50 in the entire academic year so
year.
Far.
Calendar year.
And when is enough enough is my question.
Are any Republicans who kind of beat back this original measure and replaced it with this much smaller thing, are any of them at risk of electoral repercussions?
I don't think so. First of all, I have more guns than I have people. So... But it's not for any
That's
reason.
That's not surprising. Probably not more than you have friends.
Ouch. The pre-show is just carrying right over.
He may be packing right now, Ann. Be careful when you say those sorts of things about him.
I don't think they'll face. I think this is a good step forward to make. I think the conversation will continue. To your point, if law enforcement doesn't move on this, it's going to be really hard to ultimately get the original package moving.
Republican U.S. Senate candidate Todd Rokita released an internal campaign poll this week that shows him, unsurprisingly, with a significant lead on his primary opponents.
Rokita's poll has him at 24% among likely GOP primary voters. That's compared to just 9% for fellow Congressman Luke Messer and 9% for former state rep Mike Braun. 58% of those polled say they're undecided less than 4 months from the primary. Rokita's favorability rating barely changed from a poll done last July, though slightly fewer people have an unfavorable view of the Republican lawmaker, while more people said they either hadn't heard of him or had no opinion.
John Katzenberger, this is an internal poll, so it comes with a pretty big grain of salt. But what do these results say to you?
They say Morton's doesn't have a salt pellet big enough to take this with a grain of salt. I think it says that we're seeing... every attempt to drive an advantage. I don't put any stock in internal polls, generally speaking, and especially when they show something that widely divergent. Give Rokita credit for trying to get out there and get some attention for this. But also the criticism of the poll from the Messer camp is what you would expect it to be. But I think the only poll that matters is still 4 months away, and I think it's going to be the other thing is 58% undecided for a race that's been this gnarly and this nasty for so long. That doesn't suggest a very good outcome for either of the two front runners.
Yeah, I suppose. So the Messer campaign, as you alluded to, they say this was a push poll. This was designed to get this exact result. They had a similar poll that they did internally that produced the same sort of result for them, so that you shouldn't be surprised by these numbers. But understanding that, looking at some of the other results, 58%, which is more who didn't have an opinion of Todd Rokita, is or were undecided, is that a little concerning?
In a way, I'm not that surprised, because there is a lot of internecine warfare here on the Republican side when you have so many candidates. And so a lot of the old allegiances and loyalties, I think, are being put to a test. And as we see some of the mud being thrown back and forth, I think it's causing people to just say, I am undecided. I am going to hold off until I see a little bit more. So I'm not really surprised with that. Naturally, if you're the candidate, you'd love to see at least 50 or 51% of the electorate being in your corner, but I guess I'm not too surprised at that number.
Speaking of other results, obviously an internal campaign poll you would expect to show your candidate in the lead, certainly if you're putting it out to the media.
Otherwise, that's well practice.
They don't always show that.
That's the internal poll, I believe.
I think the one that you're pushing out to the press certainly should.
Yeah,
but
that's right, yeah.
is it instructive to you to see Mike Braun with the same number as Luke Messer in that poll? Does that say something about where Mike Braun's numbers might be headed?
He's been on TV for 3 months. So if it's truly a push, I would have pushed it a little higher. You know, I wouldn't have had, because 9% seems unbelievable that they're that low among Republican primary voters. If you poll everybody, that's probably correct.
But it was Republican primary voters in this poll, so.
Republican primary voters, I believe the spread. I do think Rokita is ahead. I don't know if he's ahead by 20 points, but I believe he's ahead. I think he's just matched up kind of the energy better with the base right now. He's run statewide multiple times. That's not to say at the end of the day this isn't going to be kind of a three-way coin toss. But it seemed a little bit low with Republican primary voters, other than maybe we're all a little too bought into this idea that this is a nasty primary, and oh my God, it's going to be so terrible, and how are you ever going to make it to the general election when it's been like this? Maybe it's just that not a lot of people are paying attention right now, but they will come March.
You think there's something to that?
No, maybe a lot of people are paying attention, and they don't like any of the above. And maybe that bodes well for Joe Donnelly. I mean, when you listen to them, they sound like kids involved in a food fight. Who would you want to represent the state of Indiana? One of them, I mean, just when you think the floor is so low they can't get under it, they do.
Well, Indiana public school students would have freedom of the press protections under legislation approved by a House committee this week.
The bill would prevent school officials from censoring content or disciplining students because of it, with certain exceptions. If, for instance, the content is libelous or incites students to disruption. Student groups, press advocates, and teacher unions support the measure, but principals, superintendents, and school boards largely oppose it, arguing they would lose vital control over their schools and students. A similar bill passed the House last year but died in the Senate.
Anne Delaney, does this bill ask school administrators to give up too much necessary control?
I think if I were a school administrator, I would love this bill, because I could say to the irate parent who calls up, you know, it's not my fault. The legislation says they have to have freedom of the press. I can't censor it. I can't. And there are so many internal fights about that for personality reasons and political reasons. I think this is a very good bill and it ought to pass.
That was an argument that was made by some people in the committee hearing, including a person named Ed Delaney. I don't know if there's any relation. But
That doesn't seem to be going
over with the principals, superintendents, and school boards. Is that enough to submarine this bill?
I think they're concerned. I think they should be concerned. I think they should have some. You guys are journalists. You tell me. I mean, the bill, I believe, covers kind of 7th to 12th grade. I'm not sure what a 12th grader is writing is the same. You know, their concept of freedom of the press is the same as a 12-year-old. And they're also in the process of being trained to be journalists, so I don't think you should just the school board should be signing off on every word, the administrator should be, you know, censoring all this or whatever the attacks are on it. But I shouldn't have been free to write whatever I want and just distribute it freely in the
free,
school when
you're
I was.
You're not free to write whatever you want. The same rules apply.
13 or 14 years old.
I'm guessing John Schwannis has a different opinion on that.
I am a First Amendment absolutist, as I've said on the show before, and I applaud the rights of students to be able to learn the craft of journalism and say what they want. I will just observe, though, and this may surprise, that the Supreme Court has generally found that minors enjoy their constitutionally protected rights to a degree different and insert lesser than as their adult.
Which was brought up by opponents of this bill.
See, I cover both sides.
That's John Ketzenberg. At the end of the day, do you think this thing's going to pass?
No, I don't think so.
Is that a shame?
I don't think it's a shame. I think that the Supreme Court has determined this. I think that we should not have prior restraint. I do think students should enjoy the rights that they're allowed to have.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. My panel has been Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.